Thank you, everyone, for coming to the War College. This is the second year of the War College of Celesticon. Frank Chadwick is giving this talk about 1938 and the World War II we did not get.
So World War II, we all know, because we're of all of the generation that knows when World War II took place, and that it came after World War I. World War II started in 1939. But it could as easily have begun earlier. And I think that we tend to look at history from a very deterministic lens, that, you know, that what happened is what had to happen. And we forget, and sometimes that colors our thinking about people's motivations at the time. And I'm going to talk about 38, I'm really going to talk about the whole pre-war period, really about the whole 30s. Most of those tensions culminated in 1938 and should have produced a war and didn't, and then it finally bubbled over in 39. But it could have even happened sooner than 38. I mean, there was a lot of opportunities for warfare before 38. So one of the kind of the first marker I want to set down is I want to talk a little bit about the Little Entente. Because the Little Entente says volumes about how much we tend to look at the past in terms of the lens of the history that we knew as opposed to the history they knew. In the immediate post-World War I era, three nations formed an alliance called the Little Entente. Those nations were Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia. And in this whole build-up to war, there's, you know, a number of people speculating as to why the Little Entente wasn't more effective at or more concerned about the rise of Nazism and potential Nazi aggression and all this. The Little Entente Nazism wasn't on their radar. The Little Entente was formed to prevent a resurgence of Austro-Hungarian imperialism, because all of those countries had either been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or, in the case of Romania, a victim of it. And certainly Yugoslavia was built around Serbia, which had been both, part of it was part of the former part of this empire, part of it was an adversary during World War I. So the real emphasis, the real policy of the Little Entente was to prevent a Habsburg restoration. To the point that in the 1927, I think, the surviving Habsburg heir came back to Hungary with the intent of assuming the Hungarian crown, and the Little Entente mobilized, and there was almost a war in the late 20s over a Habsburg restoration. So when people talk about why didn't Austria get involved with the Little Entente as a check to German aggression, it's because the Little Entente was in large part aimed at Austria. Austria and Hungary never, although in this case Hungary backed down in the incident in the 20s, they backed down and then the Habsburg, that particular Habsburg era ended up dying. Austria and Hungary never renounced the idea of a Habsburg restoration. As a matter of pride, they always kept that option open. And as long as they did, Austria and Hungary were never going to be part of the Little Entente. The Little Entente was aimed at preventing that very thing. So when you think of it in those terms, a lot of stuff starts making sense. The menace that people saw at the time, and the menace they were prepared with collective security to deal with, was not the menace we think of looking back on it, having seen the actual history unfold. So let me start with 1934. And 1934 is when a lot of this stuff finally starts bubbling over. How many of you knew there was an Austrian civil war between World War I and World War II? But I want to ask you the second question. How many of you knew there were two of them?
Well, Civil War, do you mean the attempted Bolshevik takeover?
There was no full Bolshevik takeover.
Oh, it's Hungary there was, yeah.
Certainly not in Austria. The two Austrian civil wars, the first one takes place in February of 1934, where the Social Democrats, at that time Austria for the rest of its existence was in the grips of a fascist government. It was Austro-fascism. The Austro-fascism did not like the idea of German fascism, but they were fine with Austrian fascism. And it was an Austrian fascist government in control. And so in February of 1934, the Social Democrats, primarily a worker militia, rose and tried to overthrow the fascist government of Austria. That was suppressed pretty quickly by the Austrian military and police. But there was a possibility that had that revolt succeeded, there was a real possibility that Austria would have joined the Little Entente, because the Social Democrats certainly would have renounced the Austrian succession. But it didn't. You know, nothing came of that. However, a few months later, in July of 1934, was the Second Austrian Civil War, and that came about when Austrian Nazis assassinated the Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss, and there was an attempted Nazi rising in Austria, and this one came a lot closer to war, because it was in this one that Italy, which was still very much set against German expansion, offered and was aligned with the Austrian fascist movement. Benito Mussolini's Italian fascists were aligned with the Austrian fascists. When he saw that it seemed like Austria was in danger of falling, because Germany was certainly talking about moving in if the Nazi rising was successful, Mussolini had already guaranteed Austria's independence, mobilized the Italian army, and offered to move troops to the Brenner Pass into Austria to help them put down the revolt. And when he did that, when Italian troops moved up to the Austrian frontier in the Brenner Pass, the Little Entente mobilized and said, if you do, it's war. You know, because Italian troops are not going to come out of Italy, they're not going to guarantee the Austrian fascist government, they're not going to guarantee this. So Italy backed down, and as it happens, it wasn't necessary. The Austrians did put down the Nazi rising. Dollfuss was replaced by Schlichting, who basically continued to follow the same policies of Austrian fascism. But that could easily have erupted in a war. It would have been an odd war. It would have been the Little Entente and Germany aligned against Italy and Austria, and probably Hungary. So that's, the first real possible war. I mean, people are actually mobilizing. People are getting ready to shoot at each other over this one. And that's not the war we would have expected. Italy, Austria, and Hungary against Germany and the Little Entente.
This is 1934.
This is 1934. It's July of 1934. There's not much of a German army yet. Remember, the Germans have just come to power in 1933. When they come to power, there's 10 divisions in the German army. They've actually got... Those turned into corps pretty quickly each one of them with two weak divisions, which were the expansions of the so-called troop commands. So that Germany's got about 20 weak divisions. Italy's got more than that. Hungary's got about a dozen. Austria has about 9 or 10, as I recall, plus a pretty good motorized division. I mean, but it would have been a much smaller war, and it would have been a much stranger war. I mean, it's, very unusual war. But that didn't come to pass. I mean, yes?
Do you think the results of that war would have defused the possibility of World War II?
I think it definitely would. And I don't have a lot of wisdom as to how, what the result of that confusion would have been. I mean, part of it depends on who comes out on top and how much. And just because someone starts a war does not mean they're going to fight it with the intensity that World War II was fought to the absolute bitter end. There are certainly a lot of minor wars. What's that?
Fascists against fascists.
Yeah, yeah. At this time, there's really only one functional democracy in Central and Eastern Europe, and that's Czechoslovakia. Because it's also about... For some time now, Poland, the Polish military has overthrown their democracy, and it's a military dictatorship in Poland. So basically, all of Central, everything east of the Rhine there's only one functioning democracy that I can think of off the top of my head east of the Rhine at this time, and that's Czechoslovakia.
Switzerland.
What's that?
Switzerland.
Oh, Switzerland, yes, Switzerland. Yeah, right, absolutely. See, that's why I was here to say the only one I can think of.
Frank, what did the League of Nations, were they involved in this? Did they help defuse it? Did they do anything positive about that?
I don't know of any intervention by the League of Nations, because historically, it came and passed quickly. You know, everybody kind of backed down. So there wasn't really enough time for the League of Nations to get heavily involved. And the actual Austrian Civil War was an internal matter. I mean, calling it a civil war is almost, you know, it's not like our Civil War that went on and on. It's not like the English Civil War that went on and on for years. It was pretty quick, but it was, you know, they were, in both cases, they were risings that were then quickly suppressed by the police. But in Austrian history, they're called the First and Second Austrian Civil Wars. So that blows over. In 1935, all that having blown over, in 1935, Italy signs the Rome Accords. And the Rome Accords basically guarantees Austrian and Hungarian independence. And the Rome Accords are clearly aimed at choking off German expansionism. At this time, Mussolini was not a fan of Hitler's by any means, why are these fascists fighting? Well, most of Europe is fascist, and it's now a question of who's the big dog, you know, and who's going to lead this movement, absent a lot of external threat, because the Soviet Union at this point isn't going to be as much of a threat as it had been before. It's in the throes of the Great Purge. There's just a lot of jockeying for leadership in the right-wing movement. And so Italy signs the Rome Accords, which basically guarantees Austrian and Hungarian independence. That's in June of 1934. And then in October, Italy invades Ethiopia. And that's a big thing. I mean, that sets European politics on a completely different tack. Because it, up until then, Italy's been working with the Western powers pretty well. The Western powers have seen Italy as a useful block against German remilitarization and expansion. The invasion of Ethiopia really changes that. And the League of Nations, does try to get involved in that. There are a series of sanctions. The Western powers end up signing onto the sanctions. And although this takes place in 1935, that's going to play out over the next couple of years and change the nature of politics. But it's going to take a couple of years to completely finish that change. Interestingly enough, that change was almost short-circuited right away. In June is when the Italians invade Ethiopia. In December of 1935, the French and British foreign offices secretly drafted a partition plan of Ethiopia and Abyssinia that would have ended the war, left half the country under Italian occupation and half under the control of Haile Selassie, and would have ended League of Nations sanctions and brought Italy back into the Western European diplomatic community. It was leaked to the press by someone in one of the foreign offices who was just appalled at the calculated hypocrisy of this partition plan. And it hit the presses, and it was a big scandal, and that kind of preempted the plan because public opinion turned so violently against it so quickly. And so both foreign offices had to back down. But Italy had agreed to the plan already, and Haile Selassie probably didn't have much choice. Then it would have been presented to him as an ultimatum, as in fact the partition of Czechoslovakia was presented to them as an ultimatum by the Western powers in 1938. But it didn't happen, and the foreign offices had to back off of the plan once the public got wind of it. If it had been instituted without anyone knowing about it and then presented to the world as a fait accompli, there probably would have been bad feelings, but it probably still would have stood because it would have already been done, a done deal. And that would have changed things. Who knows where that would have led, but it certainly would have kept Italy in the Western camp. As it happens, in about a year, Italy's going to finally get fed up with the sanctions, and we'll see where that leads. But for now, that's 1935. That happens in December of 1935. And so at the beginning of 1936, we have a situation where Italy is kind of becoming estranged from the Western democracies. Germany has had a couple years of military rebuilding and has done some amazing guerrilla theater to convince the West that it's a lot stronger than it is. They've been taking French and British officials, air ministry officials and stuff, and giving them tours of aviation plants with big flyovers and stuff. And at one time, there were a bunch of French senior cabinet officials on a tour by Ernst Udet, who was one of the senior officials of the Luftwaffe. And there was this rejected fighter prototype. I forget the name of it, but it was really fast. But it, you know, for a variety of reasons, it wasn't what they were going to build.
HE-112.
Was it the 112?
Yeah.
It did a flyover, they'd done a bunch of flyovers as they were watching, and then all of a sudden this Heinkel prototype just went, just out of nowhere, just flying over, just like a rocket over their heads. And they said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, that's our new production fighter." "Is that in production?" "Oh, yeah. How many production lines have you got going?" "We got two now, but the third one should be up and running in about a month." Well, it never went into production, but the French went home really depressed.
Why didn't the Germans continue with it?
It wasn't as good as, it ultimately wasn't as good a design as the MA-109.
Oh. It was fast, but it didn't have any of the other features.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, it had some hours to produce it.
What's that?
It took more hours to produce.
It had like twice as many parts, and the wings were really fiddly, and there were all sorts of problems with it. Udet, I think, said, "Why don't you try some license to export production of it?" But it was actually faster than the 109 at that time. About 50 miles an hour. But the reason they went with the 109 was because the 109, the prototype, didn't have the Daimler-Benz upgraded engine,
right.
And they knew that once they got that engine, the 109 would be faster, and it was a lot easier to produce. So that's how. But the point of the story is not so much the aircraft stuff. It's what they were doing to convince the West that they were really, really strong. So in March of 1936, at the end of winter, Germany remilitarizes the Rhineland. The German army marches into the Rhineland. The Luftwaffe flies overhead in a big show of force. A lot of the German military is pretty nervous about what the West is going to do, but the West's response is to France mobilizes and sends a bunch of guys to the Maginot Line to keep the Germans from attacking them in case the Germans get really antsy. The occupation force of the Rhineland consisted of three battalions of infantry, one each in Saarbrücken, Trier, and Aachen, I think. Each one of the three big cities in the Rhineland got a battalion of infantry. The whole Luftwaffe, everything they could get up in the air, flew around overhead in big formations. They had the Heinkel 51, I think, was their main fighter at that time, which was the last biplane fighter they built. Not one of the German fighter aircraft operational at that time had a machine gun that would work. I mean, some of them didn't have the machine guns fitted. The other ones that had machine guns fitted didn't have the interrupter gears fitted, so they couldn't fire through the propeller. They could shoot for a little while. and I suspect that if it had come to war, they could have done a crash program to get those things up and running. But still, at the moment of remilitarization, the Luftwaffe was a completely hollow force. They did a great job of bluffing the West. And they did successfully bluff the West. The Rhineland occupation could easily have turned into a war. Mm-hmm. France, in fact, had earlier set up an agreement with Czechoslovakia where if Germany tried to reoccupy the Rhineland, France would attack into the Rhineland and Czechoslovakia would attack from behind. And the two of them would have this dual attack. But that had mostly fallen into issues, and the West kind of lost their nerve here. And they said, it's okay. You can have. Don't worry about that. Because Germany had administration of the Rhineland anyway. They just had. They just weren't allowed, supposedly, to put military troops there. Well, now they got military troops there, and they let that. And that moment passes. It could have been a war. It would have been a war. Germany would have had a real hard time winning. Not that the Allies would have had an easy time getting an offensive together. I mean, in 1936, none of these countries have a very capable military. Yes?
Didn't Wehrmacht have a coup ready to roll against Hitler?
Not that I'm aware of, not in 1936. In 1938, supposedly. And I'll get to that.
Couldn't the French have just rolled into it in 1936?
What's that?
Couldn't the French have just rolled into Germany?
No, I don't think so. Because although they've only got three battalions in the Rhineland, the German army at this time's got about 25 or 30 divisions. I don't think France could have rolled across the Rhine in the face of 20 or 30 German divisions. Because the
German
army,
plan was if the French fought, they were going to pull those three battalions out of the Rhineland and pretend that the whole thing never happened.
But that's certainly one possibility too. You know, that they, you know, that they would, you know, that you could force Hitler to back down, or it could be you know, that he'd go for the big solution. I don't know, but I don't know that he knew. I don't know that there were detailed contingency plans for what would happen if there was any other reaction. But the point is, there wasn't another reaction. So in 36, it passes. In 1937, the sanctions from the League of Nations finally get to Italy, and in 1937, Italy withdraws from the League of Nations. And as they do, it's a recognition that diplomatically, Italy's future does not lie with the West, with the Western democracies. So Italy, when they withdraw, in December of 37, they withdraw from the League of Nations. On the same day, they sign an accord with Nazi Germany, pledging mutual support in case of war. So, I mean, that's a watershed moment. At that point, Italy switches from being a fascist power aligned with the Western democracies to a fascist power aligned with Nazi Germany. And I mean, that's really the tipping, that December of 37 is kind of the tipping point in all this pre-war diplomacy, where it starts going inevitably towards a clash that looks a lot more familiar to us.
Civil War was already in progress at that point, but I don't know if Italy had sent the corps over to support the Spanish fascists.
In December of 37, I'm not sure if they have.
They sent their transport. They actually got transports to Morocco quicker than the Germans.
Did they? SM-79s?
So both sides.
Right at the beginning of the war.
So both Germany and Italy were supporting the Spanish fascists from the beginning.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that the ground contingent of the Spanish Expeditionary Force was there by then. So 1938. In March, so remember, December, Italy has basically told Germany that you have signed a mutual defense treaty with Germany, and not much long after that, they have told Austria, you need to negotiate with Germany and work this out, because we're not fighting Germany over you. And so in March of 38, Italy renews that encouragement, and on 12 March, the German troops cross the Austrian frontier without resistance. That the Austrian government decides not to offer any resistance to an occupation. On April 10th, they conduct a plebiscite, which reportedly returned 99.73% in favor of the Austro-German Union. I have heard it said that that may have been the last honest plebiscite the Germans conducted. I mean, given the situation, sentiment did run high in Austria for the Union for the Anschluss at that time. And it's worth remembering in retrospect, whenever somebody says Austria was the first victim of German aggression, that Austria had a higher percentage of its population that belonged to the Nazi Party than Germany did by about 1942. So I'm not sure I would call it German aggression in that sense, at least not in the same sense that other people enjoyed that experience. The French premier, Daladier, recognized the Anschluss as a dangerous first step on the road to German aggression and consolidation of German power. He tried very hard to persuade the British to stand firm and make it an issue of war, you know, to basically even go to war over the issue of the Anschluss. But the British wouldn't go along with it, and then in the joint negotiations, his own military staff said that in any event, the French army was not, armed forces were not capable of intervening successfully against Germany at that point. So, I mean, he had no allies in the negotiations, and so he gave in. When he returned to France after the announcement of the Anschluss, he expected to be jeered, but instead he was cheered as the protector of peace. Ah, le con, he said to an aide. Ah, the fools. So Daladier, I think, was one of the few people at this point, one of the few statesmen in Europe, I think, who had a very, very clear sense of where all this was going. Now, it's possible that in 1938, had that original plan to bring to end league sanctions and keep Italy in the Western sphere, had that stayed in place, had that come to fruition, it's possible there could have been a war in 38 with Italy, Hungary, France, Britain backing Austria against Germany. I don't think I would have liked Germany's chances in that war very much.
Not with 97% of Austrians in fit as Nazis.
Well, that assumes that the Austrians accepted. They later became Nazis. They were certainly a strong fascist. But if the Austrians vote for the plebiscite, accepting the situation is unavoidable. I mean, this is an unavoidable situation there. This provides an alternative possibility for Austrian independence. Now, I'll tell you, the notion of Anschluss is not a post-World War I idea. I mean, this was being talked about before World War I, this idea that Austria's future lay with Germany, not with its Slavic, Austro-Hungarian possessions. I mean, this is not a new idea, and there's a strong note of German nationalism and a push for the Anschluss pre-World War I. So it's not entirely new, and I think but obviously it isn't inevitable because Austria is not part of Germany today, is it?
Right.
You know.
I'm just sort of wondering what the correlation of forces was in late 37 as well as late 38. So those things we have to consider was the British had nothing.
The British had very little. The France would have a hard time projecting their power except against the Saar and Rhineland, and there are really no German ground defenses. Germany later builds the West Wall. At this point, it's nothing more than an engineering diagram.
Right. They didn't start on it until
that's true. But but I'm not sure the French army has a very great offensive potential at this point.
You're saying power projection. I'm looking at the Hungarians and the Austrians and the Italians. Mm-hmm. They had
30
divisions they could use at that point.
Probably it's close to that between the Hungarians and the Austrians.
And the Italians.
And the Italians. Yeah, there's probably 30 divisions there. And so that's probably a match for the German army. Depends upon how you see the relative value of those. And I'm not sure I can make that call, although in the game, this is all preparatory work for a game I'm doing with Victory Point Games. And that one, of course, we are making that call because all of these scenarios I'm talking about are parts of that game, are possible alternatives along the way. I mean, all of them are explored.
At that point, the Luftwaffe was nowhere near capable of supporting the ground forces the way it was in 1939.
No, it's not. But by that time, the Luftwaffe probably had parity or superiority over the Western Allies. The Luftwaffe was growing pretty fast at that point.
Yeah.
From the time that the Germans built about 2,000 aircraft in the first 12 or 14 months after the Nazi takeover and the Luftwaffe starts putting it. I mean, they put in a bunch of orders and they really build a lot of airplanes real quickly. Now they're planes you've never heard of. Dornier 11s and Dornier 27s.
Right. But that's but half of those are trainers.
Of the 2,000 planes, half of them are trainers. That's true, primary trainers. But you've still got 1,000 combat, modern combat aircraft, which is a substantial force at that time in Europe. I mean, if you look at the size of some of these other forces, the British have about 250 fighters. Okay. Yes. So we have the Anschluss in 1938, and we avoid that potential war. Beg your pardon?
But the next one is Czechoslovakia.
Of course, the next one is Czechoslovakia. Absolutely, the next one is Czechoslovakia. That is in, the Anschluss takes place early in 38, March of 38. By September, there's a crisis come to Czechoslovakia. and I think you're probably all roughly familiar with it, that the boundaries of Czechoslovakia, the border regions of Czechoslovakia with Germany, contained a proportion of ethnic Germans. That area, that boundary area of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, also contained a lot of Czechoslovakia's light industry, all of which was mostly German-owned and was controlled by German banking interests. So on one hand, Germany's is interested in nominally the treatment of German minorities in Czechoslovakia, but there's a real economic value in that area that they see as already German, so it's as much about the economy of the Sudetenland as it is the ethnic rights of Germans in the Sudetenland, which triggers the crisis.
Were they really oppressed?
I don't know.
I mean,
it was not. Let me put it this way: the 1930s were not a nice time in Europe to be anybody. You know, I mean, there was an extraordinary amount of distrust of other ethnic groups, and that's true everywhere. I mean, there were no. I don't think it was a particularly harmonious place to live. Or a very good place to be any sort of ethnic minority at that time. You're welcome to the club.
Yeah. Yes, the Germans and the Sudetenland were oppressed, but they also deserved every bit of it.
Well, I don't know about that. People are people. Yeah, and the fact that they happen to be born, their ancestors spoke German, I don't think makes them more or less worthy of being oppressed. But anyway, as this starts coming to a head, on 26 September 1938, the British Foreign Office issued a warning statement saying, if Germany attacked Czechoslovakia, France would assist and Great Britain and Russia would stand by France. Pretty unequivocal, right? Unequivocal. 26 September 1938, if Germany attacked Czechoslovakia, France, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union would stand united against them. On 27 September 1938, Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, went on radio and said, assured the British people that Britain would not go war over to Czechoslovakian independence. Basically just cutting the Foreign Office and the French and the Soviets off at the knees. Why is anybody's guess? But those 2 days show you the two different ways that crisis could have gone. The British, French, and Soviet government had actually kind of reached an agreement that enough was enough, but it required unanimity. And the next day, Neville Chamberlain made sure Britain wasn't going to go to war, and at the same time basically dismantled that potential coalition. Books have been written about that. And I won't give you, I'm not going to tell you any of the ins and outs or whys or try to justify or explain or critique any of that. But the point is that tells you two dramatically different ways history could have gone on those 2 days and those two statements. One would have led to war in 38 over Czechoslovakia. The other one led to the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia.
Alternatively, Hitler could have backed down and not have pushed for it.
It's possible. It's possible. There is some evidence, though, that Hitler was not about to back down. There is some evidence that Hitler actually wanted a war in 38, and that he was a little bit disappointed. Now, not that that is a product of rational decision making, but the Rhineland occupation when it comes. Everybody in the Luftwaffe and the armed forces, they want to wait 6 months to a year. And he's just impatient. You know, he just gets them, let's just go. You know, and there's no reason except he's antsy. He just gets to the point where he doesn't have anything else to do, and that's kind of next, so let's just get it over with and go on. And there's an element of that in Czechoslovakia as well. There's a sense that on a certain level, Hitler actually is kind of spoiling for a fight. And he just doesn't get it because everyone buckles.
There was also an element that Hitler knew exactly what he was doing to their fate.
Yes?
Is there any kind of written documentation that supports the fact that Russia really would have responded to Germany?
Oh, yeah.
I thought the West didn't like Russia.
They did.
Oh.
They did. They didn't like them at all. But there was, they didn't like them, but this is a period where the Soviets are really trying to repair relations with the West, and the big measure of that is that Stalin makes, got the name of Litvinov, the foreign minister. So the Soviet foreign minister at this point is Litvinov, who is a big proponent of containment of Nazism and joint security with the West against the Nazi menace. Litvinov is very Western thinking. His wife was French. He speaks French, as I recall. He gets along with a lot of the foreign ministers there on a personal level, and he's really working very hard to set up this joint security thing. The Soviets repeatedly offered to guarantee the territorial integrity of Czechoslovakia against Germany, provided their troops are given free passage to Czechoslovakia. And that's the stumbling point, because the free passage would have to come through Poland, which the Soviet Union fought a war with in the early 1920s, right? The Russo-Polish War. And the Poles are having none of it. The Poles actually have developed a working relationship with Germany in 1938. During the Anschluss crisis, as that's all coming to a head, Poland actually ends up in a war with Lithuania. There's a war going on between, a little war that nobody even knows about, between, there's not a lot of shooting, but Lithuania mobilizes and the Polish, and then the Poles mobilize, and obviously there's not going to be a big deal there, but it looks like there might be a big shooting war up there between Poland and Lithuania. And Germany had already said they wanted the Memel, which is this little stretch of, this little finger of land along the Memel River. So in the midst of this, the Anschluss crisis and this Polish-Lithuanian kind of war, Poland unofficially, through some intermediaries, goes to Germany and says, do they approach the Germans? Let me think. Do the Germans approach the Poles? I think the Germans approach the Poles and say, we're interested in the Memel, but nothing else. If you've got a problem with Lithuania, that's okay with us. We understand that we don't have any overlapping concerns here, right? And the Poles say, right, and we don't care about Austria, you know. There's this kind of very careful working out of the fact that they don't have any interests that are conflicting in these, even though both of them are really in all sorts of delicate negotiations with everything else. They decide we're okay, right? We got problems with other people. We're okay, right? Yeah, we're okay. So along comes this this Czech crisis, and the Soviets are willing to say, yes, we'll guarantee Czechoslovakian territory on our own, if we can have passage to get to Czechoslovakia, but Poland won't give them that. So,
and that's the only ones who can reach it, right? They're the ones that are closest to Czechoslovakia,
right? Yes,
France can't send an army there.
Not very easily, no. Yes,
only the Soviet army.
The Soviet army can get there. Right. The Red Army can get there, and the Red Air Force can get there. The Red Air Force can put aircraft, can ferry aircraft there pretty quickly. What was the question?
Send an army through Romania and Hungary, I suppose.
Well, if Romania would let them, or Hungary would let them.
Issues.
Those are other issues. I mean, the direct route is through Poland, and you've not only just got to get them there somehow. You've also got to supply them, which means you need a fairly secure supply route, why you really almost need someone to either allow you to go, or you're going to have to fight your way through them and physically by force open the supply road. So we have a couple options here at this point, right? After Chamberlain buckles. The first one is the Munich Conference begins on, let's back off the Munich Conference. It looks like we're coming up to a crisis. It looks like Czechoslovakia is going to be forced to buckle. But on September 23rd, which is a little bit before the September 26th statement by the Foreign Office, on September 23rd, All of a sudden, there was a whole bunch of nationwide demonstrations and rallies in Czechoslovakia for sovereignty. You know, to not back down, to not, because everything looks like Czechoslovakia is going to give in on this, and there are some real massive demonstrations throughout Czechoslovakia that Czechoslovakia not accept the Western ultimatum and not give in to Germany. The Czechs, as a result, the Czech government, as a result, announces general mobilization. And that's when the Soviets announce their support for Czech sovereignty, provided they have access. So at that point, the Czechs are willing to go. The Czechs are willing to fight. And the Soviets are willing to back them up if they can get the thing. And then the West kind of buckles. So here's a couple options. All of these are possibilities. The first thing is that Hitler announces the invasion after Czechoslovakia refuses to accept an ultimatum.
That wouldn't be easy, though. Didn't the Czechs have a pretty good army?
They did have a pretty good army.
And pretty good fortifications on the border?
Not bad fortifications on the army. Wouldn't have been a cakewalk at all. And by the way, afterwards, when the German army actually got into Czechoslovakia peacefully and started looking at the fortifications, they said, whoa, these are pretty good. Because a lot the actual Czech fortifications, and there were a lot of them weren't out in the part of the Sudetenland we think of. They're actually in the narrow part, the narrows of Czechoslovakia around Bratislava, you know, in that area, to keep Czechoslovakia from getting cut in half from Austria and Silesia. But when they get a load of those fortifications, they look pretty good, and it turns out that the Czech engineering for the fortification was based upon the engineering of the Maginot Line. They were, you know, it was a French engineering work that was kind of loaned to them, and so there was some similarities between some of those Czech fortifications and the Maginot Line, and that maybe one of the, and it's probable that the Germans studied those fortifications and made some assessments as to whether or not they wanted to hit the Maginot Line in France. But anyway, the as Czechoslovakia is about to, is willing to resist, if they're willing to resist the ultimatum, the first possibility is Hitler announces the invasion on September 7th. Hitler announces the invasion and then is arrested. Because on September 7th, 1938, Theodor Kort, who was a counselor in the German embassy in London, had actually met secretly with the British Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax at 10 Downing Street. And he said at that time that if Britain stood firm against Germany and declared war in support of Czechoslovakia, that senior German generals and Admiral William Canaris, the head of Abwehr, were prepared to arrest Hitler. But they had to have the West behind them declaring war and guaranteeing Czech something. That if this coalition stuck together, so that made the war look hopeless, and Hitler actually went to war, they would arrest him, turn him over to the Allies, and the war would be over. And the Western Allies said, yeah, sure you will. That's nice. I mean, basically the Western Allies didn't believe it at all. It's some guy in off the street from the, you know, some minor functionary in the German embassy has come here with some cockamamie story that there's a conspiracy to arrest him.
Disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think they thought it was deliberate disinformation. They just thought he was a kook or something, but it certainly wasn't something they felt was reliable that they could act upon. And whether or not it would have happened, we don't know. You know, Canaris had all sorts of plans, and you know, Canaris was involved in the July 20th bomb plot. That worked, right? So that's the first possibility. Hitler announces an invasion and is arrested. The second possibility, the West buckles. Germany invades Czechoslovakia, stands firm anyway. Germany invades Czechoslovakia. The Soviet Union comes to its assistance without Polish help. And the war is Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union against Germany and Poland. With Poland a reluctant, not an ally, but a reluctant co-belligerent of Germany because it is opposing the... Yes. Yeah, interesting. That's an interesting possibility for a war. A third possibility is the standard war, which is that Poland does not allow the Soviet Union in, but the West doesn't buckle. Germany invades. Hitler is not arrested, and you have a standard war between Germany on one hand and Czechoslovakia supported by France and Britain on the other. Mostly the war is Germany against Czechoslovakia, with the French trying to get their act together to get, before they can put some sort of offensive together in the Rhineland. But that's not going to be soon enough to take any pressure off of Czechoslovakia. The decisive theater is good. Just as in 39, the French were not able to put an offensive together soon enough to have any impact on the fight in Poland, right? It's just not going to happen soon enough. And the one I think that is the least, not the most likely, but certainly the most interesting, is what I call the Great Eastern War.
Wait. When did the Ribbentrop Pact come in?
That's in 39.
Okay, so
that's not 38. That's 39. So and really all of this fiasco that actually happens, you know, with this coalition being put together to stop German expansion, which is exactly what Litvinov has been working for all along. He's finally kind of got something going together, and then Chamberlain just, on his own, blows it up. And then at the Munich Conference, the Soviet Union was not even invited. Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union were not at the Munich Conference. The Munich Conference was westernized in Germany, sitting down carving up Czechoslovakia. And Soviet input was not even requested. And at that point, when the Czechs were willing to fight, when the Soviets were willing to fight, and the British just, and primarily the British, just sold everybody out, that's when Stalin said to Litvinov, okay, we tried it your way, you're fired. The new foreign minister is Molotov. And that's the Munich Conference and the sellout of Czechoslovakia is a decisive turning point in the way the Soviet Union looks at the West. Their conclusion from the Czech crisis is, the only thing the West is interested in is feeding Eastern Europe to Germany so that they can gain time for themselves. But they're not going to back any of us. They don't care what Germany does as long as Germany's going eastward. And so this is our future. There's no point in staking our future on mutual defense with these guys because they ain't going to be there. So that's really the effect.
They're probably right, too.
What's that?
They're probably right.
Oh, yeah, I think they're absolutely right. Now, whether or not you agree with their response to it is a different matter, but I think they're absolutely right in terms of their assessment of what their national interests were, what their national interests were and how little they could depend upon the West to serve those, to help serve those interests. So I would say that the most interesting of these is what I call the Great Eastern War, which ends up with Germany attacking Czechoslovakia, the Little Entente and Poland siding with Czechoslovakia, and Hungary and Italy siding with Germany. So you have kind of the old Austro-Hungarian and Italian axis against the Little Entente, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, without any of the other great powers involved at all, without the Soviet Union involved, without Britain. And I don't, like I say, I don't think that's the most likely one, but it's a possibility, and I think it's an awfully interesting one.
What was in it for Poland?
Beg your pardon?
What was in it for Poland?
What was in it for Poland?
Yeah.
That's really what makes it the least likely. I mean, Poland's long-term interests did lie in German containment. I think Poland was blinded by some other things. They were blinded by their hatred of the Soviet Union. They were blinded by the fact that military regime had, in my opinion, that's a different subject, but an extraordinary capacity for self-deception.
They ripped off a piece of Czechoslovakia.
They did take a piece of Czechoslovakia. But they weren't mostly interested in that. I mean, that was not. They didn't really support Germany to get a piece of Czechoslovakia. Although, I mean, it is embarrassing that Italy, that Poland, one of the victims of Nazi aggression, actually has a chunk of Czechoslovakia after Czechoslovakia goes. But
what piece of Czechoslovakia did they get?
It's a little tiny bit along the border, very little strip along the border, just around Krakow. Down in the mountains there.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not very much. I mean, it's just a little chunk of territory. It's not like big, a couple hundred square kilometers. I mean, it's not a couple, maybe, I think it's less than a couple thousand square kilometers. I mean, it's just not a big chunk of land at all. I think mostly Poland is just suffers from self, an incredible ability to just not face reality, to not face the possible future consequences of where things are going. I mean, all just as a diversion, all during the 1938, the run up to 1939, after, even though the Molotov-Ribbentrop Agreement is in place, even though the Soviet Union publicly is mobilizing, Poland never makes any provision for the possibility of the Soviet Union entering the war. I mean, after all that, when they enter the war, what? It's like this gigantic surprise, you know?
Especially after the Soviet Union is sitting on Belarus, the Poland is sitting on Belarus and a good chunk of Ukraine.
Well, aside from... I won't get into the ins and outs of, you know, the justification of the Soviet claims, but I mean, it's not like this is a big surprise. I mean, the Soviet Union has just publicly made this deal with Germany, and now they've mobilized, and then they come in. I mean, and they come in and occupy it. And when they do, it's this stunning, you know, they had no idea that was going to happen, and no provision for it. And that indicates, to me, that indicates a government just putting their fingers in their ears and going, la, 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 I can't hear you, you know. And that's I mean, about as sophisticated as it was. I don't think that the Polish government...
I'm not certain that it wasn't they were told that news series as, and they knew that meant absolutely positive, there's no chance whatever.
Well, we could speculate about that.
I know, because their Air Force had completely followed its whole war plan with Germany, and got totally caught out by, here come the Russians onto the Polish reserve airfields. That's what Polish Air Force just says, that's it, maybe there's nothing we can do, and they all flew off to Hungary.
That actually had been, that part had actually been pre-planned.
Yeah.
So that the Poles had planned to evacuate at a certain point when the Air Force was only functional. Yes.
Frank, the Soviet Foreign Minister
Litvinov,
when he was fired. Is that the Soviet gulag firing?
No, no.
Is that the Soviet
Lubyanka
bullet in the head
firing? No.
He actually survived?
Yeah.
Stalin fired
somebody? He survived for a while. I forget what happened with Litvinov eventually. But no, he was not...
Even after the purges, it was like, now he's the gentle, kinder Stalin?
No, he's not a gentle, kinder Stalin. But the purges were specific. They were direct. The first set of rounds of purges were directed to the old Bolsheviks, the ideologues, the original theoreticians of the party. They were all gone. This stage of the purges was directed at the army, at breaking the power of the army. Because by the time Stalin got done breaking the power of the party, the Bolshevik party, the Communist Party, the only other real power base left in the Soviet Union that was really competent was the army. And they should have seen the bullseye on their chest at that point, but they didn't do that.
They paid for it in the Finnish War, too.
Yeah. Stalin cleaned out the NKVD's foreign intelligence apparatus. He just had them all shot, too. Mm-hmm. And then this showed up in the U.S., and all of a sudden all the American spies had lost all their controls and all their contacts, because those guys were all called back to the Soviet Union and shot.
Yeah.
Did Molotov, was he the understudy of Litvinov?
What's that? No.
Where did Molotov come from?
We came from the foreign ministry, so you're kind of, Jack, you know something about this, huh?
Some, but he wasn't in Litvinov, I can't pronounce it.
Litvinov.
Yeah, Litvinov. He wasn't a protege of his by any means. I mean, he represented a different approach.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There were factions, Soviet foreign ministry, and Stalin didn't talk.
There had been these two competing strains in Soviet foreign policy. One, the pro-Western one, they completely go at your own. And let's say one, I'm not sure this is exactly accurate, but let's call one the more ideological and the one more pragmatic. Idealistic and pragmatic. And Litvinov certainly was the idealist of the two, and Molotov was a pragmatist. Or at least saw himself that way. Yes, Jim?
You know, the only thing that I would add is that the West in that whole period of 37, 38, and into 39, I mean, they really, really, really did not like the Soviet Union.
Right.
And I mean, both the French and the Brits, I mean, there was, Churchill's famous thing, let them both fight, you know.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's, and to me, that was the clear message the Soviet Union got. I mean, it's not like it was a new message. They've been getting it off and on, ever since World War II and the Bolshevik Revolution. But after 38, but there had always been dissenting voices. There always seemed to be the possibility that you could work something out with some of these guys, that some were easier to work with than others, and that you might still get them to see the necessity to do containment of Nazi Germany. And after the Munich crisis, after the Munich conference, it was, okay, that's it.
Yeah, the Soviet idealists were idealists, and they thought that the West would be pragmatic.
So, any other questions? Any questions?
Last plug for your game through Victory Point Games.
Yeah. Are we at the end of time?
And the title is...
The plug for my game.
Yes.
Victory Point Games, this particular game is called Dark Beginning.
Dark Beginning.
Yes, and it covers the entire period from 34 through 39, actually.
Okay.
And you can, of course, play any scenario you want to, or you've got this interesting little this kind of flowchart thing that gets you from crisis to crisis to crisis, and you kind of roll a die to see which results you get. So you can kind of do it randomly, which is the way, and you can actually get all the way to the German invasion of 39 in Case White. But
doesn't it share some other mechanics of another game you've done with them?
The core combat mechanic is the campaigns in Russia, which is actually the mechanic for Battle for Moscow. You know, that introductory game.
Really, all the way back to that one?
All the way back. I mean, this is, so that's kind of the core mechanic, and it's that ground scale, and it's that kind of core army level thing with some division breakdowns, but it's kind of a core level thing, and it's exactly at that ground scale, exactly that unit treatment. There's some bells and whistles in it too.
But it's as simple. It's not going to be a very complex game.
It's meant to be a strategic game, not just in terms of how big it is, but in terms of what the stuff you're thinking about. We want you to be thinking about that, not counting every little thing and you're putting things in a stack and reference the rule six times to see what all your modifiers are. That's not really what we're aiming for.
How many players will it be, and what will be the estimated playing time?
It's two players, and it depends on what you mean by play. I would say the playing time is just a couple of hours, because what you're really doing is you're doing a flowchart to see what war you're going to fight.
Okay.
And then it's going to be one of these wars, and that's the game that you set up on the board. And there's all those different games you can play, because the maps go from Paris to about Brest-Litovsk. They go from Venice up to the Baltic, and it's three 11x17s, and then another 11x17 split in half. So I mean, it's not even that. It's a fair sized map, but it's not an enormous map.
And there are what, 6 to 7? Is that right? About 6 to 7 different possible wars.
Yeah, I think there's maybe eight possible
eight
wars.
Possible wars, no.
Yeah, eight scenarios. They're not scenarios, but I mean, all of them are the things you can also do. You can either pick a scenario to play, or you kind of pick this random scenario generator that tells that shows all the diplomacy as to how that particular one would come about. They're always two-player games.
Okay.
There's just the axis and the odds. Yes.
For what it's worth... Craig Zink's Eurofront, he has a, the block game.
Oh, yeah.
And he has a 38 scenario that has been kicking around. I haven't had an opportunity to see it, but all the things I've heard is it's just as convoluted as you can explain it. The possibilities are...
Okay. The possibilities are just extraordinary. I mean, these are real people that, going to get really killed. I mean, it's not like, this is really cool fun. But, I mean, they are historically very intriguing possibilities, and they're not just... crazy. As crazy as they look. Years ago, I was designing a game with John Estelle, board game designer from my days at Game Designers Workshop, and he and I were working on a game called, we were going to call it ETO, European Theater of Operation. It was going to be a core army level game of the whole war and all this sort of stuff, and we were like three-fourths of the way through doing all the background stuff and trying to figure out how to make it work so that strategically people did the things they really did. Trying to figure out why they did some of these things, I mean, players need good reasons to do things. What were the good reasons that I would put in the game? John had two great insights. One of them was, he says, the more you look, people think that the Germans were cruel and ruthless. And the more you look at, they think the Germans were cunning and ruthless. And the more you look at them, the more you realize they were just cruel and stupid. And the second insight was, of all the ways World War II could have gone, the way it went may have been the least interesting. Isn't that an interesting insight? And so maybe we're going to do some follow-on games that are basically, you know, other chunks of World War II, and you can put them all together. And in that sense, it's going to be like the Europa series, but way smaller, you know. And all of those are going to be the real parts, the historic parts of World War II. But this first one is our kind of flight of fantasy. All the wars it could have been. All the wars it could have been. Yes?
I have two questions. Number one, how does Germany get the fuel and finances for what it wants to do? And number two, do you have any rules on there for Hitler being overthrown?
No, aside from what we did. I mean, one of the flowchart results is, in the game, if you get this flowchart, Germany declares, invades Czechoslovakia, boom, you fight out the war, or boom, Hitler's arrested, the Allies win, no war.
I was wondering if there was one, because it seems to me one of the great ones would be Hitler is overthrown and the Wehrmacht fights the war at once.
Maybe.
Okay, but
in terms of this game, in terms of the overall game, one of the main mechanic that I think is really interesting from a strategic point of view is that every nation's got a morale level, and what you're really trying to do is break the morale of the other nations and force them to surrender, and you're doing things, and taking major cities does that. Causing enormous amounts of unanswered losses does that. To an extent, and it's a little terror bombing does that, particularly early on.
Right.
So as you're trying to lower morale, eventually, if you can get that country down to, well, the other thing is, the U-boat war is really an attempt to break British morale. The bombing of German industry is an attempt to make German society stop functioning as well. Not a very successful one in that sense, but all those things are really efforts to get at this one thing, which is morale. Now, you can say morale, if German morale reduces zero, you can say that means Hitler was arrested. You can say it means everybody throws in the towel, but for whatever reason, you have to get, for a country to stop resisting, you've basically got to get their morale down to zero. And sometimes that means overrunning the whole country. Sometimes you can do it before you overrun the country, like France in 1940. You could argue that Poland never quite throws in the towel. You could certainly argue that parts of Yugoslavia never quite throw in the towel.
Yeah.
So you've overrun the whole country, and their morale's still there at two, and partisans start. So it's a mechanic that I think on a strategic level can work pretty well and get a lot of...
This is what I was leading up to, because, see, I helped write Call of Cthulhu, a bunch of other games. One thing with Call of Cthulhu was a steadily descending sanity. What I'm suggesting is that you can work in German financial and oil problems by having a steadily descend. The longer the war goes on, the worse it gets for Germany because they don't have any oil unless they have an alliance with Russia or something.
Yeah. Resources are part of it too. I don't want to get into details.
There's an economic gap in Germany and the Soviet Union. What suddenly gives the Germans the wherewithal to keep going?
Okay, thanks for the ideas. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
When do you plan on being available?
We're going into play testing on this first game in short order. And I just finished up the last. Interesting enough, one of the things that caused me to do a lot of weird research was putting together the aero bees for all these scenarios, because like the German Air Force, they have two or three planes, but they're different in every scenario, because we got rid of the Dornier 11s, now we got these. So everybody's kind of swapping out planes as they go. In the early scenarios, the 34 scenarios, like the basic British fighter is the Bristol Bulldog biplane, and the Virginia bomber, this big biplane, open cockpit bomber is the basic heavy bomber of the British Air Force. I mean, there's some real wonderful antique planes in this game. So anyway, So we just finished all that stuff. We're going to go into play testing probably in the next month. Victory Point Games is really good about putting out really cool play test kits that basically finish your play. I wish I brought one with me because I've got a play test version of my game Golan Heights. It's a brigade level game of the 73 fighting the Golan, and the play test kit is spectacular. But maybe so in the next month or so, and then we'll see how it goes through play testing. I would guess sometime probably early next year.
Okay.
I would guess,
just
but
check
I know
their website periodically.
What's that? Yeah.
Just check their website periodically.
Yeah, yeah. And then the stuff after that, we'll just see. You know, we'll just see how they're, they've got a really, they do like 24 games a year.
They turn out nice looking stuff.
Yeah, they do nice looking stuff. They do like 24 games a year, but half of that's, you know, kind of Euro game stuff. So about, they do about 12 war games a year. And there's a bunch of other series that they're doing. So there's like a lot of competition for slots in the production schedule. So don't expect they're going to, I doubt they'll do more than one or two games in a particular series a year, because the alternative is to let some of their other series just go foul completely. So it could take a few years to get this whole thing done. Yes?
What was the name of that the German airplane that fooled the French in 1950?
I think it's the Heinkel
112.
The 112? I think it's the Heinkel 112. I don't recall offhand, but that sounds familiar.
Thank you, Frank.
Oh, you're very welcome.